Mother's Day is almost here, and you can get her the most beautiful time-tested gift around. A watch she can wear every day from Movement. Whether your mom is into classic dress watches, rare and refined ceramics, or tried-and-true bestsellers, Movement has something she'll love. And right now, everything at Movement is up to 50% off site-wide during their Mother's Day sale. A watch is a gift that celebrates all the time you spent with mom. And a Movement watch is even more than that. Movement uses industry-leading materials for their fresh, modern watch designs, from technically complex ceramics to vintage-inspired style, all for an incredible value your wrist and wallet will both love. And with one-size-fits-all convenience and fast, free shipping and returns, it's a stress-free shopping experience. Save big on the best Mother's Day gift ever with Movement. Get up to 50% off site-wide during their Mother's Day sale at MVMT.com. Again, that's up to 50% off at MVMT.com.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Hi, I'm your nuclear submarine pirate captain, David Marquet. Welcome aboard. And you're listening to the Agile Uprising podcast. This is going to be better than a Disney cruise. Arrgh.
Hello and welcome. I'm Andy Clef, and I'm excited to be joined by David Marquet. Welcome aboard the USS Agile Uprising, Captain.
Hey, it's great to be here. Arrgh. That's the theme for tonight.
So in your first book, Turn This Ship Around, you described very passionately your experience as a captain aboard the nuclear attack submarine, the USS Santa Fe. And when you took command, the ship was... how can I say politely, underperforming.
Yep.
however, after just a year, the boat was recognized as the most improved ship in the fleet. Less than 2 years, she had shed her infamy completely as the worst boat in the Navy and started winning awards as the best ship in her class. Early January, you released a companion workbook, same title, Turn the Ship Around, designed to help others apply the framework that you developed and refined over those couple of years. As you experimented, that framework that built a community based on personal responsibility and trust. There's a couple of paragraphs that I'd love to have you read that set the stage for this transition.
Sure. Imagine a workplace where everyone engages and contributes their full intellectual capacity, a place where people are healthier and happier because they have more control over their work, a place where everyone is a leader. All of this is possible, but not with the current leadership paradigm. Our world's bright future will be built by people who have discovered that leadership is the art of enabling. The steps getting there are evolutionary, but the result will be revolutionary. Mm.
That struck such a chord with me, and I hope many of our readers pick up the first book and this workbook. Because what you describe sounds a lot like an agile transition to me in software development shops. I wanted to start finding more about your education as a naval officer. I'm not sure that many of our crew understand what it takes to develop the skills and understand really the basis of pretty pure command and control training. So tell us a bit about your sub-school days, what it was like, what you were trained in, what the paradigm was then.
Yeah, so I grew up in the 70s. I graduated from high school in 1977, and it seems like a long time ago, but we were in this contest with the Soviet Union, and things weren't going well for us. Inflation was high. The oil crisis had come. Price of gas went up by 4 one afternoon. And the Iranians had taken our hostages. We couldn't get them back. And it was basically dismal, and they were very kind of dark days. And I was this really sort of geeky kid in school, and I was like the chess team, math team kind of guy. I was on the computer club, which at that time meant you got access to this, you know, big machine in the back room where you had to type in, you punched your stuff out on tape and you loaded it in the computer at night, and you bought time in the evening, and sometime at 1 a.m. your computer would run your tape and it would let go by 4 inches and hang, and you'd figure that out in the morning. And it was very unforgiving. But anyway, I was very passionate about the way humans should live, and I thought that the idea of a liberal democracy was a better idea. And I wanted to do something about it, but if you're an introvert and you want to, you know, you want to join the military, which is kind of what I'd made my mind up, what are you going to do? You got to go in a submarine because your job is to hide from people. So that, I thought that fit pretty good for me and my personality. And I ended up going to the Naval Academy, and they gave me this book, and it said, you know, here's your leadership book. And I was, an avid student. And my leadership book said the following: leadership is directing the thoughts, plans, and actions of others so as to obtain and command their obedience, their confidence, their respect, and their loyal cooperation. Boom.
Wow. I think we still use that book in corporate America.
Some people do. Yeah, some people do. But even if we don't overtly use it, I think there's this, it's in the veins. It's in our veins, in the movies. I just watched the last Star Wars movie, and that's exactly how they lead. And not just the bad guys, the good guys too. It's exactly how they do. And this is the image we have of leadership. And we like to laugh at it and poke and say, oh, no, there's no way anyone would do that. No, that's what we do. Anyway, so I was scary good at that. And because I was kind of a smart kid, I was pretty good at figuring out what we needed to do and telling people to do it and, quote, motivating them, which really means just kind of kicking them in the pants. And so I got promoted, and then it all changed. then it all, the wheels came off.
Was this in the 1990 when you took the helm to Santa Fe?
Yeah. So what happened was I got selected to be captain of a submarine, which was great. I was super excited. And then I got training for a year to be the captain of one ship. At the very last minute, they said, oh, no, you're going to this other ship, Santa Fe, because the captain of Santa Fe quit a year early. And the Santa Fe was the worst performing and the worst morale ship in the Navy. Only 3 sailors in a 12-month period signed up to stay in the Navy off the Santa Fe, which was a wreck.
And so that's a huge metric, retention.
Yeah. Yeah. And it should be, you get about 30 to 35 people leave the ship every year, and you shoot for about half of them. You want about half to stay in the Navy. And anyway, we had 3.
Wow. So if I did my research right, there's about 110 people.
Yeah, we actually have more like 135. There's 117 bunks. But we overstuffed the submarine, so some people had to share.
Okay. There's not a lot of room to share. One guy has the head at one end and the head at the other end? Or...
Well, you time phase. One guy's on watch, the other guy's sleeping, the other guy gets up, he stands watching, and then the other can sleep.
Okay. So you're trained, you get on this boat, this is the highlight of your career. You're the captain of a nuclear attack submarine. You take control and you think, I can do this. So what? It's the worst boat in the Navy. I can do this. I did well at school. I can give orders, right?
Yeah. Well, but the problem was it was a different kind of submarine. And you know that. Like you look at the gear and you don't really know what it looks like. Gear is all different. Physics same, gear different. Buttons different. Code different. So, you know, logically you know that. But you're so ingrained in this mode of giving, telling people what to do. And the crew expected it. And I gave an order. Well, here's what we did. A submarine's like a Prius. It's like a hybrid. You got a reactor and electric motor, but, you know, not, you know, so it's a little more powerful than a Prius. But
yeah, a little bit.
Our favorite thing is to shut down a reactor and pretend that it's broken, but we actually shut it down. And it's because you only have one. And then you shift over to the electric motor. And then the race is you got to get the reactor fixed before you run out of battery. So that's the very – so I take command. I had 2 weeks – take command, go to sea, do the drill. Reactor scrams. You call it a scram drill. You shut down the reactor. And the officer who's in charge of this thing is doing everything right. Everything's fine. And he's shifting over to the electric motor, and he's going along at the slowest speed, like first gear on the electric motor. And I'm like, hey, let's shift into second gear. Let's go a little faster on electric motor. It'll drain the battery faster. It's going to put some stress on my team, right? Because every other submarine I'd been on, there were always two gears for the electric motor, slow, first gear, and then second gear a little bit faster. And faster just drained the battery really fast. So I suggested, and he orders it. He says, put it in second gear. And the young sailor does nothing. He makes a funny face. I notice that. And I'm, this is like a big deal, right? And I'm like, what's going on? Why aren't you doing, what the officer ordered? He says, Captain, there's no second gear for the electric motor on this ship. It's a one gear motor. Just like in this most like matter of fact, like you're a dumbass kind of voice I've ever heard. And so I said, wow. And I looked over at the officer. I said, what? Did you know that? And he's like, yeah. And he gives him this grin. I'm like, well, why'd you order it? He says, because you told me to. And my head literally exploded. And I'm like, hold on a second. Because in the past, you give bad orders every once in a while. And what we normally say is, oh, you got to give a better order. You got to give better instructions. But it's just the nature of giving instructions that eventually you're going to give a bad instruction. And by the way, I couldn't learn a whole nuclear submarine and give good instructions. So I talked to my guys and I said, what are we going to do? And I wanted to give them a lecture and say, you guys need to speak up. I will still keep telling you what to do, but if I tell you something wrong, you speak up. But eventually I was talking and I just was listening to myself. I just sounded silly. I said, that sounds ridiculous. I said, well, let's just skip that. You're never going to have to tell me I'm wrong. You know why? Because I'm never going to tell you what to do.
Wow.
But you guys just come to me. Don't ask permission. Just come to me and say what you intend to do and make me stop you. So in other words, rather than saying I need permission, and unless I say yes, it's no. You're going to come to me and say that's what I intend to do. And unless I say no, it's yes. So we shifted the whole bias to a yes, and that created this bias for action. And it got everybody thinking. And it was scary because things were slow, and I would go out there and I'd say, I'm not going to tell them what to do, but I really kind of think we need to be doing this, but we're not doing it, but I can't tell them. So, it's sort of, hey, what do you guys think? What's your plan? And but once we got going, it was amazing.
That's fantastic.
And it kind of cascaded down the submarine. Everyone started thinking, started saying, this is what I intend to do. Stop me, get out of my way. And we were off to the races. And it was really, really awesome.
I love that story. The power of language.
I'm a huge fan of language. I spent a lot of time thinking about the words. We spent a lot of time thinking about the words that we said and trying to make them as precise and concise as possible and appropriate and accurate. And you change your words, that changes your thinking, changes your life.
One hopes so, right?
I got another example if you want to hear it.
Yeah, please do.
So we were screwed up in all kinds of ways. And one of the things that we were screwed up in was running fires and fire drills. And afterwards, people look around. We didn't call it a retrospective, but it was basically that. We do the drill, and then we get together and we say, okay, how did it go? And then it'd be wrong. And then we say, okay, what happened? Well, they didn't do this. They didn't do that. They didn't put the batteries in. They didn't hang up the gear. And I was like, well, who was all this? They, I like beat my fist on the table. And because we're we're all trapped in this tube together. There is no they. Like, it's just us. To say, from now on, you can't say the word they. And we had all these theys, like engineering, weapons, operations, supply. Those were theys. Chiefs, enlisted men, officers. Those were theys in hierarchy. I said, they is not allowed. You can only use the word we. And people started saying we and had to refer to anybody else in the team as we. Now, a submarine at 135, it's right at Dunbar's number. So you can know everybody. Yes. Everybody can know everybody. And that will actually – so what happens is people would come and visit and say, this is an amazing culture of teamwork. And I say, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, it feels like such a team. I say, no, you don't get it. We have a rule that we say the word we. That's it. You say, yeah, but it feels, but what happened was by saying we repeatedly, when you tell your brain we, you refer to this other person as we, your brain says, oh, they must be on my tribe. They must be in my tribe. And then your brain rewires itself so that it feels like when I look at that person, oh, they're in my tribe.
Yeah.
But it starts with saying the words.
Now, is the size of the ship and Dunbar's number a coincidence? Or do you think that's part of this, the human dynamics of the Navy's design of the boat?
You know, I will tell you, I never heard of anyone refer to Dunbar's number until afterwards. But I think it may be just happenstance that it works out that way.
There are so many parallels in this story to agile coaching. For the coaches listening, we all remember when we went through training and we're told not to give answers, just keep asking questions. And when you broke that, you made sure that your questions were open-ended and didn't hit to the solution. And it invites everybody into this realm of discovery and an opportunity for empowerment and improvement. And it is such a shift in transition of power. But I'm curious how you and the other officers let go of ego in this transformation. Because right, your training is, I am the leader. I am the authority. I've made it this far. My crews, you know, nobody's been through officer school like me. So nobody can do what I can do. They need me. They need me to solve the problems. Obviously, you know, the stories that you gave about, you know, put it in second. We don't have a second, Captain. Began to pop that balloon of ego. But how did that go for you?
Well, it's weird. A lot of people ask me that, and for me, it didn't feel like I was sacrificing ego. It felt that it was a little bit scary being vulnerable. The other thing was I would go and ask the crew questions about their equipment, which on every other ship, I would know the answer. And on the Santa Fe, where they would say, yeah, I don't know, Captain, I don't know what that button does. And they look at me and I would say, yeah, you know what? I don't know either. Let's find out together. So two things. Number one, I call it care, but don't care. Care, but don't care means care deeply, passionately about the people who've been entrusted to your team and the mission you guys need to accomplish, but don't care about the bureaucratic consequences to yourself. And if you have that care but don't care attitude, you can do anything. Like, there's no excuses. You just do the right thing. And I think, because all I wanted to be was a submarine commander. A lot of these guys, they think, oh, now I'm going to be the next, you know, admiral, and then I'll be the president of the United States. And so it's all about that. And that's just, you know, just do the best you can do in the job that you're in, and everything will work out. The second thing is I focused on – so here's the thing guys get wrong, I think, leaders get wrong, is you want to be firm in the how, in the process, but release control of the what. And so, for example, Agile does – I think Agile has this about right. In Agile, we say, look, here's the process. We're going to be doing, say, two-week sprints. And at the end of the sprint, we're going to do a celebration and review. And then we're going to do a planning session. And then we're going to keep a backlog. And then we're going to launch into the sprint. Nobody will, by the way, during the sprint, there's no good idea fairies allowed. You can just, if you have an idea, put it in the backlog and we'll review it in the next sprint planning session. And we're not going to tell you what to work on, but we're going to specify how we're going to work, the way of working. And what I see is leaders, either they're loose on both, and that's sort of a messy chaos, or they're strict and they're strict, which feels overly rigid. So I sort of accidentally ended up, because when I said things like, you know, don't say that, no, they on Santa Fe, I was sort of hard about that. And if you came up to me and said they, blah, 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 I just wouldn't talk to you. I wouldn't listen to you. I wouldn't give you a lecture, but I wouldn't talk to you. And so a lot of the things that we came up with in terms of how we work. I think if you come up with the right algorithms for the bureaucracy and the hierarchy, then that allows you to release control. That's why I love Agile, because I think it's basically a set of algorithms for running the hierarchy that allows releasing control of what happens.
Absolutely. And you described that, you know, the Scrum approach where you have this time box of an iteration that has a goal. Right. It's the equivalent of the vision or the mission that you're currently on, and you've divested into the crew that's building this thing. Complete ownership and trust. So you took control of this boat. You have about $1 billion worth of taxpayers' money. You scared me a little bit when you say, hey, I don't know what that button does either. Maybe we should push it. No, not that one.
Don't tweet that. Yeah, we didn't do that.
But so how did you...
That's for dramatic effect.
We'll get some sound effects in there. So how did you describe... developing competency and clarity as pillars of this transformation. Can you dive in a little bit about how you did that and built the trust with your crew? And then later, I want to talk about how you got trust with your superiors.
Yeah. So I screwed this up too. So you know, clearly, like if you would have said, well, what do you do? What are you doing? I said, well, you know, I'm empowering my people, which starts by you keeping your mouth shut. Okay. We think that we're going to I'm going to just keep doing what I keep doing. And then they're going to somehow be empowered. But no, it always starts with our own behavior. So only when you lean back, I think about it, I lean back and allow them to lean into me. But what happened was I went too far and we made a big mistake. We dropped a piece of gear. Fortunately, we didn't hurt anybody, but it was very scary. And it turned out in retrospect, I'd given too much control, too much, in other words, decision-making authority to my team. I'd relinquished too much decision-making authority. And we talked about it, and the team said, you know, things are going so much better already, even with this screw-up, that we really want to keep doing it, but I think we're missing these two pillars. And then we ended up coming up with competence and clarity. In other words, the amount of control that you can give the team is not unbounded. It's tuned. It's a function, it's an output variable, and the two input variables are competency and clarity. And so at some point, most organizations, when we poll them, two-thirds of them are operating below the line. In other words, we can give more control without any more training. But at some point, if you want to keep going, you got to spend more time training on technical. The competency is technical training. Right. Like, I can't let you make decisions about the nuclear reactor if you don't understand nuclear reactors. Right. And clarity is, what are you trying to do? Is the purpose or your why?
How did it go upwards for you with your superiors?
You know, great, because my boss didn't really know what we were doing. what he saw, and he was on the ship. He rode the ship, and he saw how things were getting better, and people were stepping forward. In a way, what we did was very minor. We simply, you know, everyone who was used to saying, I request permission to do ABC, now was saying, I intend to do ABC. But what he saw was all the output metrics, which immediately showed the ship was doing better. Over the next 12 months, every single sailor, 33 out of 33, signed up to stay in the Navy. So now we were setting records on the other end. We got the highest score that the Navy had recorded for operating the submarine in an inspection. And everything was good. So my boss was happy, went on to, you know, he had six submarines he was responsible for. So Santa Fe wasn't one he had to worry about. He went on to other things. So, and I think in his mind, we were, you know, I really learned the ship quickly. I was giving really good orders. Not, you know, I basically stopped giving orders. He did a very important thing, which was he incubated us. He protected us so that, because initially, you know, there were some ups, but there were also some downs. And I had a guy I talked to who implemented our program at a major drug company in the diabetes section of this drug company. And he said when he got promoted to take over this new division, which was sort of, you know, flatlined. And he went to his boss and he said, give me 6 months. We'll report for the accountants, the sales and everything. Because we have to, but as far as you and I are concerned, I don't want to talk about any of these, any money metrics for 6 months. Give me 6 months to work on this team. And sure enough, when they lifted the curtain, things had gone through a dip, but they were on a strong upswing at that point. And it's a great story because it's all about same things. Everyone, all your listeners would recognize, you know, giving the people the authority to make sales calls, who they wanted to call on, when, how they wanted to sell it, you know, all that kind of stuff. Connecting with the end user, understanding what the drug was for, how they were saving people's lives, and that kind of thing.
And also, you highlight one of the practices, and we'll cover more in a bit, of saying, leave me alone for a certain amount of time. You described that the annual performance appraisal being a key point in as a practice where you'd sit down and you'd say, okay, I want you to write your performance review for a year from now. Where are you going to be? What is the future vision? And it sounds like in this pharma example, it was, give me 6 months and you'll see results then. Don't worry about how we're making the sausage, but this is the future state we're going to achieve. And you balance this release of control, but still holding people accountable, but not on a daily basis, not on a weekly, not on a quarterly basis.
Yeah, I think you got to shift to a long, like if you're always trapped in a short-term performance mode, you're never going to get better. And I felt it all the time. So because we got inspected all the time. So let's say, you know, here's a situation. You're pulling, the ship's coming into port, which is it's an infrequent thing to do. You know, you might do it 20 times a year and you're close to land. So it's a little bit dangerous and that's when groundings happen. So anyway, so if I you're evaluated basically every time you pull in a port. So knowing that I'm going to be evaluated, I put my best officer up there. But if I do that every single time, at the end of a year, I only have one guy who's got experience driving the ship into port. And I've got 12 other officers who never did it, but I'm just reacting to the organizational stimuli to win in the short run. So you got to put that aside and say, I want to win for the long term. And now I'm going to have a whole stable of officers who can drive the ship because they've all had experience doing it. It's a very simple example, but we always would try and, I would take my calendar and I actually had it flipped to 6 months in the future. And this, I had a physical calendar and I'd always say, imagine it's that day and I'm thinking I'm my future self and I'm thinking back to today. Now, what do I really wish I'd done? And it almost always would kind of break me out of my short-term panic.
I love that. But you've got to leave what we call slack time for the changes, whether it's competence or training or practice or failure and re-experimentation and success to do that.
The problem is it feels like that slack time, it feels like you're wasting time, right? Because you're sitting there and the team says, what should we do? And you think, you know, hey, turn left, keep moving. And you resist doing that. And you say, well, why don't you guys work on that and think about it? And at that moment, you feel like nothing's happening, okay? But something very important is happening, which is they're learning to solve their own problems. They're engaging, they're thinking, they're learning that they can solve problems on their own. They don't need you. And the next time they're going to come up, they're going to say, hey, this is what our plan is. This is what we intend to do. You just need to get out of our way. So for me, that was always very uncomfortable. And as much as I say kind of glibly, oh, yeah, I stopped telling them what to do, it was – of course, I didn't, especially when I was stressed out and got, you know, mad myself or something happened. But it's about just being consistent and trying to stay in that long-term mindset.
You described coming into port as a strong feedback loop on this whole experiment of transitioning from command and control to team-based leadership. And you have a section in your books that you call Embracing the Inspectors. I want to talk about that a little bit.
So up to this point, like I call it the difference between a prove or improve mindset. And up to this point, my Navy career, like you're continuously being monitored, evaluated, graded, and inspected. Every officer has a score that goes up and down on based on every inspection. It's fed in some big database, and it's a secret. You don't even know what it is, right? So I always felt like I was in proving mode, which I didn't like. I felt it put me on edge. It made me nervous and anxious when I was in these inspections, and it wasn't good for me. And somehow, as part of this whole deal, we kind of put that whole thing aside, and we said, look, guys, well, I remember what we did. We got together and said, what is it that we all do? I want a mission statement that we all can all do, that we all associate. And we kept engineers like, well, we run the reactor, but the weapons guys, well, that doesn't apply. We boil it all the way down. And the only thing we could come up with, the thing that everybody did on the ship every day was learn. So I said, okay, that's our creed. Every day we learn. But no matter what it is, I want you to learn something. And I sort of tried to embrace it myself. And so when the inspectors would come, my guys would be like, oh, hey, let me just show you what's going on. And here are the records. And I just, look here on page 125. We kind of had, that was a very complicated day. I'm not sure I got it documented right. My guys were like showing the inspectors where to look for the problems. And the inspectors were like, these guys are crazy. But they were so keen to learn. Two things happened. One, we learned and got better than anybody else. And two, the inspectors were so taken by this attitude, because it wasn't defensive and hiding and, oh, you got to find the problem. Now, every time we're on the edge, we always got the nod. So that was, but probably the most important thing was, I remember going into these major inspections where in the past I'd be sort of nervous and anxious and how's it going to go? And I was just, really just calm. My heart rate was low, almost looking forward to saying, well, what are we going to learn? Because in these inspections, you get to do things that you don't normally do. You're shooting torpedoes and missiles, and, you sneak up, under other ships and stuff that, you don't normally get to do. So it's really exciting and fun. You're taking your race car through its paces. And that was really, that learning attitude is really important.
Talk about exciting end of iteration demos and sprint reviews, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, torpedo away.
So you talked about some of the failures and some of the successes. What were some of the things that you did to reinforce and amplify the positive outcomes of your experiments on board the Santa Fe?
It was, that wasn't hard, because everyone immediately felt, I thought the story was going to be, we get better and then we feel better. But I think what really happened was we felt better and then we got better. And I think what happened was, when I started saying, look, guys, we're a team. And I talked about our mission in a way that wasn't really fashionable. I said, we're here to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. That's an important thing. Why is that important? I don't know. What does it say? Like, what does that document say? We're not here to get rich. We're not here to be pirates. We're here for an idea. It wasn't fashionable to talk like that, but they had all volunteered and it made sense. And so what happens is, you have a sense of purpose and they have a sense of teamwork, and then they have a sense of competence and they have a sense of control, because they're getting to decide what they want to do, and they feel better. And it's the feeling better that came first. And then that translated into better performance. So I didn't have to do a lot. The crew did it. The only thing I had to make sure I did was, if there were people who were sort of sticking the muds and weren't really playing, and my instinct was, oh, I'm going to go give that guy a lecture. I need to get that guy on board. But I really had to, I just resisted that. I just ignored them. I just did my, like, they'd walk by me in the chow hall, I wouldn't even say hi. I would just be kind of a jerk, because I said, the best way to do is just ignore those guys. That's a natural consequence of them not playing. Cause a lot of times it's just a play for attention. Right. Oh, so I'm going to have bad behavior and you're going to spend more attention on me. Like, no, I'm not going to spend any attention on you. I'm going to spend all my attention on people who are trying to do the right thing. And that was really important for my budgeting, my personal energy and emotional, what I had in the day.
Yeah. I'm reminded so much of the four simple values that come out of modern Agile. And you've described them all. You make your people awesome. And even the ones that are somewhat dysfunctional, you give them the space to become more awesome. You're allowing your crew to experiment and learn rapidly, tolerating failures. So you're making safety both of the vessel and the crew, but of the experiments a prerequisite. You described your postmortems that were blameless.
Yeah.
And getting better and delivering value that you monitor in many different ways, both the scores of the officers and the morale, which was reflected in the retention of the crew.
Yeah, the very first underway, just about 3 or 4 days after I did the shift into second gear screw up, we pull into port. It was our first underway, first time at sea, pull back in, and we screw something up where a sailor has shut a breaker they wasn't supposed to. And we have a big critique. This is kind of potentially a big deal. So I've invited all the outside organizations and agencies who monitor nuclear submarines. So the wardroom was full of all these inspectors. It was a very sort of solemn event. And I'm sitting at the end of the table, and the poor petty officer is sitting at the other end. So this is like a 22-year-old enlisted guy with all these impressive captains and commanders looking at him. And I said, "Hey, tell us what happened." And he says, in a very honest voice, he says, "Captain, I don't know. I wasn't thinking. I got ahead of myself, and I just closed the breaker because I knew that was coming up, but it was the wrong thing to do." I said, "Thank you very much. You can go." And there was this audible gasp because at that point I was supposed to punish him or do something. Everyone looked at me, and I said, "Okay, guys." And I just talked to my guys. I ignored all the outside inspectors, even though they were standing right there. And I said, "Look, guys. He came in yesterday trying to do the right thing. He told us the truth. He could have hid it. He could have made a bunch of excuses, and he didn't. So we're going to figure out how that doesn't happen again, and we're not going to blame him." And we sat there for 6 hours talking about that. And fortunately, he given us a clue when he said, I didn't think. I just shut the breaker. I said, how do we inject thinking into everything that we do? And that set us down a path that really had transformational results on the submarine.
There's a section where you describe the differences, and it's nuanced, between empowering and emancipating the crew. I want to take a couple of minutes and tease that apart and how emancipation is fundamentally different from empowerment. In management circles, you hear occasionally, you must empower your people.
Yeah.
But in fact, it's slightly different. How do you tease them apart in your mind?
Yeah, part of it's a reaction to the word empowerment, which I think has kind of been polluted and it's just thrown around, doesn't mean anything. I've been to these things where the boss says, "Oh, you're now empowered," and I'd say, "Well, what does that mean?" "Well, empowered." "Like, no, can you spell it out?" "No, well, have more power than you had yesterday." I said, "Okay, so wait a minute. So you're telling me, it sounds like you're the one with the power because you're telling me how much power I have."
Exactly.
So I'm saying any model where someone else can tell me what my level of power is or can, quote, empower me is not empowerment, right? That's just you sort of, bequeathing some alms upon me. I say, so real empowerment, first of all, don't disempower people in the first place. And real empowerment means you got to let them make decisions, not, okay, I'm going to second guess everything that you do or anything like that. And so for me, because a lot of people, once they heard about what we were doing, they would say, "Oh, yeah, that's like, that's empowerment." And I will tell you, you can talk to anyone who was there. It really felt different than that. It felt like guys have used the words, and they said like it was like shackles getting removed from my ability to think and do my job. That's the kind of words that they would say. And I say, that sounds like emancipation. So let's free ourselves and free your people from, having to get permission. Empowerment means you still get half. What empowerment means for most people is I'm still going to approve everything, but I just want you to come to me with more ideas. But I'm still going to be the approving authority. So that's not empowerment. So when you say, "Look, you get to decide what you're going to do," and unless I say no, now I didn't go to the point where I said, you just do whatever you want and just tell me. I kept the crew at the intent level, which meant that they would have to come to me and say, I intend to surface the ship. I intend to load a torpedo. I intend to start the reactor. I intend to speed up, you know, whatever it is. So we could have a conversation before the thing actually happened, which I thought was an important ability for – that was an important thing to make it safe for both me and them. But the idea was that unless I said no, you were going
to
do it.
Yeah, it comes back again to what we were talking about earlier, the power of language.
Yeah.
And I love how you tease it apart. So we're coming up on our time box here. I want to give you a chance to share any upcoming events, book tours, stuff that you've got coming up in the next couple of months. What's going on for you, David?
Yeah, so I'm really excited. I'm going to be in Amsterdam on the 17th of May at the Agile Leadership Conference over there. I love going to Agile conferences. Agile conferences seem to love me, and I tell stories. And, you know, we sort of – one of the things that I think is another parallel is I couldn't tolerate my people just always thinking and having ideas. There are times when I just need them to follow a procedure. Like when you load a torpedo, now you open up the book and it says do step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. If you don't do it in that order, bad things happen. And so we got – some of my guys got confused because they're like, well, do you want me to – think and make decisions? Do you want me to follow? I said, well, no. Sometimes we're going to think and make decisions. Sometimes we're going to be in the doing work. Sometimes we're deciding. Sometimes we're doing. And we kind of developed this back and forth, which I really think is very similar to what Agile's trying to get with in terms of sprint planning. You know, we're deciding what we're doing, and then we're going to go into doing. And oh, by the way, when we're in doing, no good idea fairies, right? So I'm going to get the chance to be in Amsterdam on the 17th of May. And I'm also excited about this workbook that we just launched, the Turn the Ship Around workbook, which is it's a significant upgrade from what we had out there before. And I've got one of my chiefs, he's written some chapters or some sections in it about what it felt like for him in the middle. We've added some research, which validates why what we did worked. And we have a bunch of activities that leaders and teams can do on their own if they want to try and move in this direction.
Oh, that's great. I'll put links to both books in our show notes. What are the best ways for listeners to get in touch with you, Captain?
I got a website, davidmarquet.com, and you can check that out. We also have, this is fun, we have a thing called Leadership Nudges. And these are little 60-second blurbs of me, typically on my, it's like little selfie videos of me just giving a tip, a reminder, every Wednesday. You can go to YouTube, subscribe there, or on the website, you can enroll and have them show up in your inbox, because it's not so much about, hey, you need a lot more training, you just need reminders of how to be the leader that you want to be.
I'll include links to that. Well, thank you, sir. Been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you also to our listening audience. If you enjoyed this episode, give us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcasting platform of choice. And if this is your first time tuning in, subscribe, catch our next show. And if you'd like to join the discussion about cruising along at 20 knots at a depth of 400 meters, join us at coalition.agileuprising.com. And finally, please consider becoming a patron for much less than the cost of a single stainless steel rivet on the hull of the Santa Fe. There'll be details in the note as well. Until next time, this is the USS Agile Uprising rigging for silent running.
Credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin Marshall credit card bill.